Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Ingrid Chris-Johnson, and she will be speaking on City Lutherans in Action. What happens to the summer offerings taken at Holden Village?
Well, we're going to spend some time explaining what we know about City Lutherans in Action, because it's one of the recipients of Holden's summer offerings. I'm going to start out by reading something about the background and history of CLA. It's just two paragraphs, so it won't be too onerous. And this is written quite recently. This is written just a couple months ago, so it's pretty current. By the way, did you write that announcement that went? It was in the...
Yeah.
Right. Thanks a lot. So a little about the background and history of CLA. City Lutherans in Action is a 7-year-old network of Lutherans and Lutheran congregations who are active in transforming their communities. Founded at a convening conference on urban ministry in Kansas City in 1989, CLA is currently made up of more than 500 Lutheran individuals and congregations from across the country. Members of CLA are men and women, laity and clergy, Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and ELCA congregations who are toiling in the urban vineyard bringing real change to the communities they serve. Why a national network of Lutherans? Early leaders of CLA stated that too many congregations in the urban setting existed in isolation. Intentional steps needed to be taken to foster relationships among city folks, to build a voice of unity within the city, and to create new opportunities for learning from each other. CLA is not a coalition built around a single issue. Rather, it is a network of Lutherans who are committed to sustaining a strong presence in the city. The network is built on relationships, and through relationships, we have found that Lutheran congregations can more effectively minister to the poorest of the poor in our cities. Urban Lutherans have stated that they can no longer minister effectively as separated entities. Lutheran congregations need to be in relationship with other Lutherans, Christians of other denominations, Jews and Muslims, community organizations, and other institutions. So that's sort of the founding statement. Then there is a mission statement, actually, that I like, too. And that says, "We are children of God by baptism, Lutherans by denomination. With Jesus, we cry over our cities in love. With all the saints, we see a vision of the city of God. We are committed to living and serving in the cities of the world. We join to encourage one another, to advocate for God's forgotten people in the cities, to share ideas and experiences, to lift up ministries in cities, to empower people, both lay and ordained, for urban ministry. We are City Lutherans in Action." So those are some of the background pieces about it. Ron has been active in CLA for some time. My living room is a place where it frequently meets in Chicago. So my husband is very involved in it, and I'm on the fringe of it. So, but I do work in urban ministry through my job as director of the Urban Studies Program for the Associated Colleges of the Midwest. And many of the things that we do in urban studies are things that are transferable into CLA, and we do sort of feed each other's fires. So I know some things about it too. I guess we should, there are, what, five?
I think four focus areas.
Four focus areas?
Yeah, really.
And Ron and I will take turns explaining them. They're education, advocacy, a conference, resource development, and networking.
The conference.
And the newsletter, Just Cities. So, I'm going to tell you a little bit about education. One of the focuses of CLA is to work with Lutheran seminaries. because it's a sense both of the professors that we talk to in seminaries and of Lutheran pastors who've been educated in seminaries in recent years that seminaries really don't know very much about urban ministry. And since this is, there are many urban pastors who are in CLA and who are concerned about how to do urban ministry better, it seemed logical to start at the point where pastors are trained and do some, and help seminaries do some more training about how to do urban ministry. We don't think urban ministry is so different from other kinds of ministry, but I think it is significantly different in some ways. And so it seemed worth making a special focus on that. In Chicago, one of the things that's happened is that LSTC has asked CLA people to do an urban plunge for their faculty. And the whole faculty took part in it and spent 2 days going through an educational experience in the city. And one of the things that we did, what we tried to do when we set that up, was take them, take the faculty, you know, who are very diverse and not all interested in urban ministry, but who had agreed to go through this process, took them to a variety of sites in Chicago that are doing really exciting things. So we showed them models of stuff that works. We didn't just show them pathos, you know, or sort of horrible things, but we showed them exciting things that are going on in the city that really work. So we visited sites, we talked, had them talk to real people who are active in sites, and learn about the kind of ministry that's going on there. And I suppose this would be a good time to mention the sort of theory that at least lots of people in CLA have bought into and like about urban ministry, which is the notion that people get better ministered to if you think that they have capacity, if you think they can do stuff to start with, if you think they're people with skills and abilities and resources, rather than ministering to them as though they are totally bereft and needy. My vision of the bereft and needy thing is, those of you who are my age or older will remember a radio program when we were younger called Queen for a Day. And in Queen for a Day, it was a radio program I loved as a child. They had three or four women who would come to this radio station, I guess in New York, and they would each tell the story of their life. In they would try to outdo each other in terms of being heartrending and bereft and terrible. And the one that was the worst won. And she got a washing machine and a dryer, or just a washing machine, I guess. Yeah. It was really awful.
How bad she was.
Yeah. So the one that had the most pathetic life was the winner and was the queen for a day. And but that's really the way our public welfare system works, and it's the way lots of our ministry to the poor works. If some community can persuade us that they have the worst drug problem in the city, then we'll devise a drug program and sort of funnel resources into their drug problem. And we all know how successful it is. It's not successful. It doesn't work. But that's what we do. We pour lots of money into that. Or if they can persuade us that their teen pregnancy is the worst, then we'll devise a teen pregnancy program and sort of funnel resources into that. And that doesn't work either. And we never know, you know, we always say it's pouring good money after bad, or it's, you know, why doesn't it work? And that we never ask the people in the community what their ideas would be to address these things and what they can do to make their lives better. We want people in communities to accept the largesse of the society and behave according to our guidelines to get into programs and do stuff, then we can't figure out why it doesn't work. So let me tell you two stories that are a different model than that, that CLA people are pretty interested in. One is a community on the south side of Chicago that is completely poor and that people don't have any resources and they're mostly on public aid and the community's pretty bombed out and it looks awful and it's, you know, a poor urban community. A group of seven women noticed that every week in their community, everybody in the community practically took a pocket full of quarters and a big bag over their shoulder and left the community to do their laundry somewhere else. So they would bring these quarters to somebody else's laundromat in some other community through some distress of theirs. They had to walk a long way or find money for the bus or something. Do their laundry and then carry it back. Well, they decided to write a small grant and got a little foundation money to rent or buy a storefront. There were many, many, many empty storefronts all over this community. And to get some used industrial strength washing machines and dryers and set up this little, the People's Wash and Dry. And in the People's Wash and Dry, they had a round table with a coffee pot on it, and people would sit or do their laundry and sit around this table and talk. Well, they, those seven women, have made this into a successful business. It's contributed to other businesses growing on that same street. It's a street now where people can go and do business. Other ideas have hatched around that round table with that coffee pot, and they've thought up other ways to grow some business and some capacity in their community. Well, it wasn't so hard. I mean, these women, you know, could figure out how to run a laundromat, and then all those quarters stayed in the community and didn't go to some big chain laundromat somewhere else. So that's a sort of capacity building thing that worked well. Now, a bigger one is my husband and a few other people were involved in getting some funding for a conference. They had a series of these, but one of the conferences was on the west side of Chicago. The people, when asked their problems, to describe the things that they didn't like and the things that they did like in their community, the list of things they liked was that there were lots of artists in the community, people who could play instruments or who knew how to paint or knew how to make things. And there were lots of women who were good cooks in the community, who would cook food that people liked. The kids liked, everybody liked this food. And there were people who were good at cleaning and housekeeping, and there were people who could do things. What they didn't like was drugs and the kids being on the street, and they didn't like the school system because the school system had stopped teaching the arts and fed the kids food they wouldn't eat in the school lunch program, and you can see where this is all going. They got all, and the money in the community, when you sort of thought through, now let's see who's got money here, the money was all federal drug money that was there to fund programs. So it paid salaries of middle-class people to come in and do things to the community and then leave again. So the conference that they put together, getting all these people together for 3 days to talk to each other, was of all the artists they could find in the community, people who knew how to play the trombone or paint or whatever. The local school councils, because in Chicago now we have local school councils that have control over the schools and can decide, for example, the schools all closed at 2:30 and just remained locked until the next morning, but we kept heating them all night and the lights stayed on and stuff. So the local school councils had control over the school from 2:30 on now, and they could decide, let's open them again. So, and they wanted the kids to be taught stuff in the arts, they wanted the kids off the streets, they wanted the kids not to get into drugs, and of course the federal drug folks wanted to spend money in a way that would help keep kids off the streets and keep them off drugs. So all of these things have come together into a program that pays local people to, the moms go into the schools and cook the school lunches, and the kids eat them and like them. The artists in the community are in after-school programs in the schools to teach arts to the kids, and the kids are off the streets. And, you know, so there was a sort of sense that this community could do for itself and did do for and is doing for itself in some healthy ways. And once you start recognizing the guy walking down the street that maybe used to drink too much or something because he teaches you how to paint, or to play the trombone, then that guy starts taking his role in the community more seriously. And he starts thinking, I'm important here, and I can do some good stuff. And he starts to know the teenagers that he used to be afraid of. Or, you know, so it breaks down all that stuff, and people start to relate to each other as human beings with capacities and with gifts to give. So I think that that whole kind of underlying philosophy is important in CLA in terms of how we think about urban ministry. What role do urban churches have? What do they do? And that's some of the stuff we showed to the LST to bring this round. That's some of the stuff that we showed to the LSTC faculty that they got excited about. The idea that they could teach their seminarians to view people as people with gifts to give, not just as needy vessels that they had to pour stuff into, because that changes the way you do ministry. So that was one thing that CLA, I think, has been important in. It's a national organization, but that's one way it's acted out in Chicago. They've also done some stuff at Luther in Minneapolis. I don't know what, but...
And some CLA folks have part of a program with Trinity Seminary in setting up internships in Detroit. Kind of a comprehensive, instead of just that might be your urban internship and now you come back to Columbus, Ohio. You were prepared the whole year for your urban internship and you spent the whole senior year kind of in relationship to your teachers in Detroit.
So that's one, the urban ministry piece. Ron, do you want to talk about advocacy?
I'll skip to kind of networking in general first because it goes well with this kind of stuff. But these kinds of stories, and Ingrid's right, that most of us involved in setting CLA up and that decided to keep it going even when money was tight and time was tighter, took this approach to urban ministry. And the thing that I think kept us going through a lot of kind of the downtimes was that a lot of these stories, the reason there's not a people's wash and dry in every neighborhood and in every city in the country is because the government, who poor people have to interact with more than the rest of us, and police structures and educational structures and church structures don't think that way. And pastors aren't necessarily trained that way. And so these things spread because the story gets told. And one thing that CLA is really probably one of its most valuable features is its networking capacity. A lot of times through the newsletter, there's the one constant in this newsletter besides the title over the years has been Tales of the Cities, which this one has three, sometimes you know, we'll have three or four pages of short paragraphs describing something that worked somewhere, so that if somebody was facing a similar situation, they could call Pastor so-and-so in Milwaukee and say, how did, you know, tell me more about that. Some folks in my church have been thinking about that too. And that exchange and that relationship is much more valuable and much more time efficient for a pastor or a congregational leader than looking through resource books out of Higgins Road, which isn't to discount those, but urban pastors don't read those for the most part. And so setting up these kinds of conversations and relationships through networks in the newsletter and at the annual conference has been a valuable way to kind of spread these stories and try to attach a name and phone number to each story so that if something grabs somebody, if somebody successfully integrated a bunch of older Swedish immigrants with the new Hispanic residents of their neighborhood into a congregation that was working, other people in similar context want to know about that. And instead of having that person write it all up in a book form, we try to put them in touch with each other to share their stories and to then become kind of develop mentor and exchange relationships where they can help each other with stuff. that's a good part of what the newsletter tries to get at, and is a major part of what the annual conference each year tries to get at, which is one of the third focuses of CLA, which it was born out of a conference of people who around the country. At that one, there was even about six people from Seattle who were concerned at the formation of the ELCA that a lot of the conversations around how the new church would operate weren't taking into account the ministry that Lutherans had been doing in the city, and felt that there needed to be a voice that was church people, but separate from the broader institutional church. And so they had this conference to talk about all this stuff and decided to form CLA out of that. And so the conference has always been kind of an important thing for folks in the organization to go to. And every year has a theme. This year it was youth ministry in the city, because that's a whole different ball of wax than when I was a youth director in Thousand Oaks, California, where it was just different. I mean, I have very little to offer people who are doing youth ministry in the city, but there are people who are figuring out how to make that work. So they tried to bring those folks together with pastors who are trying to figure out how to make that work, and try to bring a lot of the resources together with people who need them. But every year has a theme, and for a lot of folks, the main point is to get together with a bunch of people who are doing what you're doing and struggling with what you're struggling with. For pastors, for sure, it's been a support network, because urban ministry can get kind of lonely sometimes. It's been usually a kind of idea generator, primes the pump to try to get through to the next year, and makes contacts with other folks who may be able to help you with something you're working on at the time.
Those site visits, I think, are really important. So whatever city it's in every year, right, on President's Weekend, it's always on President's Weekend, they do a lot of site visits. So you go and see in whatever city you're in the stuff that's happening that's exciting, which is inspirational, too.
And there's always great dialogue at the conferences between lay folk and the clergy there, too, because they tend to have a different cut on the nature of the ministry that's going on in cities and how they can support each other. And occasionally we've brought in folks from divisions of the ELCA that impact the cities through some of their programs. Or in Minneapolis, we spent a lot of time with David Olson conversing about some of the proposed new structures of the bureaucracy and how that would impact cities and how he was going to respond to that. And I think that conversation continues in Minneapolis from what I hear. But they're a lot of fun, and they're a big boost, really. The advocacy piece of CLA has kind of ranged over the years. The one that's most on the front burner now is a resolution for the, is it 96? When's the next big assembly? This year?
It's this year.
Is this year?
It's in 2 months. One month.
Too close in touch with that stuff. But this all grew out of the Division of Outreach was kind of restructuring and started to feel again like the urban desks and the people who paid attention to cities was getting lost. There were some people who were really questioning whether there still was a commitment on the part of the ELCA to ministry in our nation's cities. And part of that was tied to the whole seminary piece. There was a question about whether our seminaries were training people to survive in an urban call. Most of them were getting bulldozed as soon as they got out there, and because they're just skills that they weren't learning. So all that kind of combined into a resolution to go before the assembly, which I haven't seen its latest version. I saw, is it the one that went through Chicago?
I don't know.
The it got tested at several synods, and I saw the copy that passed in Chicago, the Metro Chicago Synod. And basically, it just kind of ups the ante and says, we know you'll say you support urban ministry, but we want you to really kind of put your money where your mouth is, and we want a commitment to train 50 pastors who are capable to go out in their first call and at least start to do urban ministry and survive personally and professionally and to set up some programs in the seminaries where they can get the training to do that, as well as some continuing education programs. A lot of what we've pushed for in CLA is to use people who are doing urban ministry well to be kind of the teachers, to bring them into the seminary out of the parish one day a week and teach folks what they've learned, and then use the theologians in the seminary to help the students kind of reflect on that based on all the reading they're doing and kind of enter that dialogical process. So that the resolution that's going before the assembly has some specifics to it in terms of ELCA commitment. Do you have that?
Yeah, this is the one that was passed down here. This is the model resolution.
Oh, cool. Well, you can read it and know more about it than I do right now.
It's long, and it has lots of specifics to it.
It was partly inspired, too, by the folks who are involved in rural ministry around the country put together at the last assembly a resolution seeking some affirmation for the value of doing ministry in rural areas, even though demographers would say that's a dying part of our country, that to say it was important and that there's some specific ways the ELCA can do ministry in Appalachia and North Dakota and other places. And those folks were energized by that process and by passing that resolution, and I think gave us a lot of encouragement to go with that and have supported this resolution. That there's a lot of similarities between rural and urban ministry, and there's been a lot of sharing that way.
I think CLA would really advocate for a more attention paid to how to do multicultural ministries. And seminarians need to learn that. Seminarians need to learn how to listen well and respectfully and talk well and respectfully with people of many different cultures. And that's something that cities can teach. So it's an important thing to raise up and to take seriously as a church. We're surely not going to change it or continue to incorporate a variety of people into the Lutheran Church unless we get better at doing that. And the demographers tell us that that's the way to grow, that's one way to grow the church, that people are interested in church growth. But it's just a way of doing the right thing. And so I think that that's a way that CLA can and is being helpful to seminaries, and also just to pastors who are out there trying to do urban ministry. It's so awful to do something by yourself, to try to invent how to do it without support. And so it's really wonderful to have a sense that there are people you can talk to about this stuff and confess your weaknesses and your fears and your lack of ability and get tips and help. And, you know, not always to do magnificent things like Bethel New Life on the west side of Chicago, but just to do everyday, regular pastoring to your flock.
I think for me, one of the most inspiring stories of CLA goes all the way back to the first conference, where a bunch of lay folks from Detroit and two pastors drove to Kansas City and drove back in a blizzard, which was a key component in the story. Because they got inspired, they saw a lot of stuff, they got excited, and then because it was a blizzard when they left, they had lots of time in the car to discuss these things. The results, though, I mean, the results are still going on, but they got back and they just looked at their neighborhood in a whole new way. They looked at their church and its place in their neighborhood a whole new way. They started organizing their blocks around their church through their church and set some modest goals for their block. But within the next year, when we were visiting that church for a planning meeting, they had convinced the city to some buildings that were falling apart and being used by drug dealers, which of course was interfering with people going to church as well as interfering with life on that block. And the church brokered between the neighbors, who would then buy the lot next door for $1 and turn it into community gardens. And then there was some large building, like an old American Legion Hall down the street that was closed down and had been a problem. And they got a hold of that and turned it over to some people who had the capability to turn it into a youth center and a community center. And they just had a whole new, all of a sudden they went back, instead of saying, oh, we're a little Christ Church in this fierce Detroit neighborhood, they came back and they said, we're Christ Church and this is our neighborhood. And we have something to say to you besides what's said Sunday mornings. And it was just an exciting feel. And a lot of the people from that group have gone on, got more theological education, and starting to move around the church and spread these things. They all say it came out of that car ride back from that conference. And I tell this story because I think there's some elements in there that, getting inspired from each other, going back with some new energy, and just something as simple as hearing stories and then cultivating them amongst your own group, and then going in back to your own place and doing it a way that fits that place, are the kinds of things that come out of this kind of work.
And I suppose that means that you have to be willing to talk about economics, you have to be willing mm-hmm. to talk about organizing. You know, as a church, you don't just say, well, everyone's private life is their private life and we'll just worship together on Sunday morning and hope the kids come to Sunday school or something. But
you know, I served a church for 13 years in the inner city of Phoenix, and I noticed, and so I went to some meetings like this. I don't know if I went to CLA meeting, but how old is CLA now?
89.
Yeah. But I noticed that the churches that seemed to do well in the city were ones that got over sort of the mythology that the church shouldn't deal with property or things like that. In other words, in many places in the city, the only kind of community that can take on housing issues, for example, is some kind of a real grassroots community, and that can be the church. In other words, a lot of churches that finally would say, we're just going to have to take over the housing issue in this neighborhood because no one else around really cares. All the bankers only do it to get money, and they don't make anything on their investments in this situation and all that. So it seems like those churches that finally kind of got over that idea, and not they didn't do it to make money, but did it so that an organization that actually supported good housing for people worked. And a lot of, that's just one example, it seems like, though, and I think you're right, is that in the city, it's really kind of a good opportunity because there are many places where property and things can be got for cheap. Mm-hmm. Even for some of these programs, like you were saying, for $1. Mm-hmm.
And things like urban gardening really do change a community if people work together. And you know, there are lots of stories about churches that have gotten cheap properties, old, really dreadfully dilapidated, run-down, drug-infested, abandoned apartment buildings, and had the church folks in there plumbing, wiring, painting, plastering, wallboarding, and then get apartments ready and rent them at low rates to people in the community. And then pretty soon, and you know, you can set up tenant management so that they screen their own who can move in, which poor, you know, all families on public aid, but what do you look for? How do you screen who should be in there, and who should clean, how do you divide up cleaning the public spaces? most of those buildings that I go into are immaculate, much more so than middle-class buildings, because this is theirs, and this is their chance, you know, and they divide out. And I've been in buildings like that in Chicago where if someone, some family's arrears in their rent, they have a bulletin board in the lobby, and they, anybody who's arrears, their name goes up there, and they're like, you know, and someone's on their doorstep, they want to know why, because this is their building. So there's this wonderful thing that happens when people start to feel empowered about their own spaces, and I think urban churches can really do that. You had your hand up.
Well, do they still have things like the National Parish Training Lab that they used to have in training ministers?
I don't know anything about
the Parish Training Lab.
Last I heard, it was down to like a one-weekend bash led by Warren Sorber.
And because you were talking about training, you know, seminarians and clergy and things. And then what about EI in Chicago? Is that, where is that at these days? Is that still training clergy for urban ministry? Is that gone? Or
It's named something different now. It's on the corner of Sheridan and Lawrence, and it's often used as a retreat center. So people can hire... I mean, can rent rooms there. I don't know whether they do any of their own training things anymore or not.
Just 20 years ago, they used to do this thing where this immersion business, you know.
Right, the urban plunge.
Right. But then they train people how to organize communities and things.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's more of a resource building, I think. We had a CLA conference there.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. I was going to ask, too, how many are identified as, how many urban ministries, so-called, are identified in our ELCA? And how many people attend a conference? Just a guess.
I used to have these numbers.
The last conference, I think, had 80 people at it.
They range from 80 to 120.
Okay. And how many ministries would you say the ELCA has that we call urban ministry?
I don't think either of us knows that.
Okay.
I do know that in Newark, New Jersey, we have one parish with Pastor Gladys Moore.
Yeah, my experience, I was in urban ministry in Dallas for 9 years, and that network, I remember that we would just almost count the casualties of churches closing and churches, because I think we did have that view that there weren't any resources there, and that these people didn't have any gifts or abilities, you know, and that we were pouring, as you would, things into it, as if it were empty. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of the community organizing helped change that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's still some rub there on that very issue, in that, you know, a lot of these congregations aren't, the people who go there don't have the resources to support the operation of a church and the salary of a pastor. And so they get support from the ELCA.
Right.
And there's the ELCA has formulas, not quite as complex as the welfare system, but close. And you have to have a certain number of people, worshiping members, and a certain budget to qualify. And if you fall below that, they start kind of sending you letters saying this is a problem, you might lose your funding. And part of the problem with that whole system is was amplified really well by Steve Uhlberg, a pastor in Kansas City, who is a halftime pastor of a very valuable church, a very valuable ministry in a very poor part of Kansas City, where, you know, when they ask him, well, how many members do you have? Well, he has about 25 people who've, like, gone through the traditional new member classes and joined. But then when he says, you know, how many people are members of our church community, he lists 250, because the whole neighborhood relies on this church and its ministry, and people come there for safety sometimes, they come there for meals sometimes, they have community events there. The last mayor of Kansas City joined that church because that's where he got fed, but he wasn't joined like a member joined. And so, and that happens a lot in the urban scene, where people don't go through kind of our traditional new membership structures, but they're certainly part of that larger church community. And so there's kind of this difficulty in measuring urban ministries and how to give them support and stuff like that. And that's something that CLA folks and people in the ELCA have been in congenial dialogue about with no answers.
One other thing that I think we need to help each other do, and that is this business of partnering, not just mission partners, which is a formal program, but partnering where we can leverage these things that you're talking about, property and food. There's a model in Boston, East Boston, called NOAA, Neighborhood of Affordable Housing. And that started with a grassroots movement with a suburban congregation and members of the urban congregation. And we met for a year with people in the community and just listened, everybody. And then $30,000 was invested to buy a triple-decker. And we convinced the bank to buy the first one. And then all the people who are indigenous in that community did all the work. We happened to be among a Cambodian refugee, mm-hmm. with some indigenous Italian.
And they probably got trained to to gain skills.
And some of them came with these skills. Mm-hmm. And so we refurbished a triple-decker and sold each unit back to these people on 30-year mortgages. Recovered our money and bought another one, and they've done, I think, 9 or 10 with the original $30,000.
It's a wonderful model, and everybody could do it.
Oh, yeah, and it doesn't take millions. Mm-mm. You know, it doesn't, but there were 11 people from a parish, I think we only had 50 families, 11 people over a period of years contributed as an investment.
And urban parishes always say, people in urban parishes always say they're happy to partner with suburban or other wealthy parishes, but they don't want that to be a financial arrangement. They want it to be a person-to-person, human arrangement, first and foremost. And then if money follows in some meaningful way later, that's completely different from saying, oh, this rich parish in the suburb is going to send us a check every month.
No.
That's not what they want.
No, when we met for a year, we had meals with these people and new first names, mm-hmm. and the money thing came last.
Yeah, I think that's the way.
Is there any, like in the CLA, any people doing, or other groups that you might know about, doing some analysis of where, for example, where is our society at right now in terms of, well, just sort of in an anecdotal way, what does it mean that people who live in beautiful places like Appalachia can't survive there, you know? And what does it mean that people who live in the center of the city, which sometimes the city can be a wonderful place, you know, there's art, there's like, I guess my best model for a city that I've ever been in would be Paris. And Ernest Hemingway describes Paris as one big house. And he says, you know, you go downstairs from your apartment and you have croissants and Café au lait, and then you walk three blocks and you go into an art gallery, you know. You walk another two blocks and there's a beautiful park, you know. And I mean, it's just wonderful. Life can be wonderful in a city. And life can be wonderful in Appalachia. But why is it, you know, that in so many places in our country right now, it's not wonderful to live in either one of those places. It's a struggle. It's painful, you know. I mean, what's wrong with our society that's not happening? It is to some degree, but it seems to me we can look at these personal ways that small groups get organized or parishes do.
But
we also have to look at the big macro system. Mm-hmm. What is forcing so many millions of people to suffer?
I do know that in the Division for Church and Society and the ELCA, besides the fact that we do more work than the sexuality statement, we do all the, I mean, we're responsible in some sense for our affiliation with all the Lutheran social services and Lutheran hospitals and nursing homes and adoption agencies and immigration and refugee services and disaster relief and, you know, hunger money and all that stuff. And the big conversation there now is a sense of terror, really, of what's happening, because services across the board are being cut to the poor, to the helpless in various ways. There's, I mean, the whole Republican sweep of state houses and Congress means that there's a real change in policy that says there's going to be a lot less available to fund services, good programs and bad programs alike. And the hospitals are aware of the fact that their federal funding is being cut. And they're at the same time as more people are going to end up needing hospitalization because they won't have had the preventative stuff that involves nutrition or housing or things like that. So they're going to end up in crisis in hospitals, and hospitals' funding is being cut. So things are not, I mean, in all those areas that you're talking about, things are not looking up. Things are going to get worse before they get better. And you know, if the churches are supposed to respond to that, the funding in the churches, I mean, our board meetings for DCS, every board meeting but one since the church merged, we have cut our budget. So a lot of the work of the board, of the division of the ELCA that's designed to address problems of the poor, you know, the work that the ELCA does with the poor, we just cut programs. We look at slideshows of programs, we learn about them, and then we cut them. Or we hear reports about them, and then we cut them. We figure out ways to do less. We sometimes just shave, and every program gets shaved some. And frequently now, we do the other thing. We completely cut out whole areas of our work. Or when someone on the staff resigns, we don't replace them, and then we put their portfolio divided up into three other people's portfolios. And so the church is doing less and less at the same time as the government is doing less.
So where is the money that the ELCA, Division of Church and Society, where does your money come from? Does it come from individual congregations or from
It comes
synods?
Through churchwide. All money that goes to churchwide from synods and congregations goes through churchwide, and then all the divisions of the churchwide submit budgets, and then we get and allocated a certain amount of money out of the total pool.
So does this mean that total giving has gone down because it's...
Giving to churchwide has gone down.
Yeah, in the last...
8 years.
8 years.
I was going to say that it seems like as a culture, we're in what, you know, everybody calls the paradigm shift, you know, in the sense of old models, new models, how do you create a new one? And there's a whole movement called the communitarian movement, which may be the next wave. And that I just think in terms of Clinton, that he got elected with a lot of hope, but we were still putting the hope in the person, and he got eaten up by the system. And so now the Republicans are kind of putting up their hope. The system's going to, in some sense, destroy that too, because it's not a person that's going to save us. And so I think the more education CLA can do, in one sense, to the congregations and to the people that support it, and really talk about the empowerment model rather than the draining model, which is what people think of in terms of welfare. And in terms of, you know, maybe doing some more of this urban plunge. I've been associated with Plymouth Youth Center in North Minneapolis for many years. And when I was in college, we did something which was called Journey to the City. And we had kids come in from the farm and from suburbs, and they would go to the social agencies and they would see what was going down. I mean, and a lot of those kids would never come to the city. They would just be afraid. And so I think, the urban-rural, as many connections, as many stereotypes as you can break down and lower, in some sense, the voter level or the congregation level, you know, you can go to the seminaries, you can go to the people, but in some ways, you know, you got to get to the people that are funding it. and yeah. start introducing some other models, because you can just see it in terms of that we're a country built on individualism, but where's it gotten us?
Right, absolutely.
I want to say that there's some broader issues that we really haven't touched on, which is the basic change in our economic structure. It has nothing to do with Congress, but the fact that we've shifted to an information society. I think we've left a good many people behind.
Mm-hmm. And so then as a society, we have to figure out who we are mm-hmm. and what we believe and where our values
well,
are.
And how to bring others along.
How to keep the doors open.
My sense is that the question is more if we're going to bring others along.
Part of it, but I think part of it is just the disruption, just like during the Industrial Revolution. That I think people have not found a place.
What I see increasingly is that people absolutely are hardening their hearts to the poorest of the poor. They don't want to see them, acknowledge them, think about them. They just want them to die. They just want them to write them off. And that's
my experience on the west side of Chicago, where I spent the last couple of years working before I came here, was, I mean, it was definitely a place that was hit by that shift. Families that for years, whose parents maybe migrated from the South, black families whose parents migrated from the South to work in factories and expected to pass on factory jobs to future generations, which supported a family. Those factories closed down, moved out to suburban areas or Arkansas or Mexico. And so there was these big blocks of empty or factories operating at a very minimal capacity. As the economy shifted more downtown towards people with education to operate computers and to push paper enough that it looked important, and that those folks then got left out of that process. And I think Ingrid's question of what if we will is important, because in other shifts, in the shift that brought those very people to the west side of Chicago, it was a conscious decision on the part of kind of our political business structure to bring people. We needed more people in the north operating these factories. Black families were recruited from the South to come up and to invite their cousins and others to come up too. And so there was a definite effort, because there was a profit motive to it, but it was a definite intentional effort to kind of put those folks into the economy in such a way that made life for black America in the 50s, 40s and 50s a lot better than now, where there's no effort to bring those folks into the new economy. And because there's a fear amongst those of us who are white men that we may get squeezed out, and amongst others, that I think there's a definite, not just negligence, but I've seen things that I would call proactive efforts to keep those folks out of that part of the economy, except for maybe, janitorial services. That was just my personal experience.
I think the anxieties are very real. I don't think it's all just hardened feelings. I think that people almost at executive level all have anxieties.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, they do.
That's, how can you get beyond that?
Well, I think, you mentioned the schools, and it seems to me that all the institutions are being examined, and my husband is part of the team that's running the Minneapolis Public Schools. They've gotten quite a bit of press, Public Strategies Group, and just trying to shift that so the schools start meeting the needs of the people in the community, and the opposition to them is unbelievable. It has to, and I think, again, you start doing those cooperative pieces where it's not just the church, it's not just the city, it's not just the schools, but you start having what you call sort of the community places where people do the round tables, where they start coming up with their solutions. And I don't know, public strategies might not be the one, we don't know, but but the opposition, both from the minority community and then from the school board, and you know, I mean, but just to try to do itty bitty shifts, it's just awesome. So, you know, I think it's all the institutions that are being examined.
Sure.
And the healthcare is going to be re-examined again. I mean, we're just a culture that the old, I think what you just talked about in terms of the real shift, you know, we have to decide as a society, do we want these people to come in, be part of it? Or are we going to continue to, in some sense, educate them so poorly that they don't have the options anymore?
Well, the numbers in Chicago are pretty clear on that right now. Of all the kids who start school in Chicago, I guess all the kids who start high school, two out of every four, 50% of them drop out or get pushed out by their 16th birthday or on their 16th birthday. And lots of kids tell me that the schools save up in fractions, and when they come to school on their 16th birthday, they're told they're out of there. And then, of course, they could get back in if their parents knew how to work the system and be aggressive and who to go see at Pershing Road. But their parents are waitresses, and they don't know how to do that stuff. And so a lot of kids, I mean, they're out. By the time they're 60, half of them are gone. And then of the half that remains, only half of them can pass the literacy test. So if you're a parent in Chicago sending your kid through the school, statistically one of your four kids is going to be able to get a job when she or he turns 18.
And graduate,
yeah.
Did you have something else?
I was just going to... John Gardner retired from Stanford, and a lot of his work on the history of community, his kind of theory is that this paradigm shift that we're talking about, I think, that in America, we had defined community as a collection of individuals that were connected through something, like the factory thing you talked about, or the shift from the agrarian to the city, or that we were bonded or we related through communities that were ethnic, Norwegian churches or whatever. And I'm not criticizing that. It was an important piece in the transition.
All those associational pieces.
Exactly. But now what's happened is that those things which connected us, networked us, out of either a sense of common survival or a shared history or whatever, are going away with this generation. Mm-hmm. And the waft is coming out where we're all standing exposed as individuals. And part of that was fed by this rugged individualism, you know. But the fact is that we just don't make a difference, you know, alone. And so it is being bulldozed by that.
My husband does writing in this area, and he tells a story about the number. Just look at the statistics of people who used to bowl in bowling leagues, and now the number of bowlers in our country has gone up, but they bowl alone.
Mm-hmm. See, now we thought that I think some people believe the information age and the joke about email and all that. But my sense about it, as I talk to my colleagues and listen to people who know how to do all of that, is that's a very elitist group. And, I mean, and I'm not, again, criticizing that as a network, but it's a network above the rest of people, the email network, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got to have the price of a computer to get into it.
Yeah, right. Thing,
plus the knowledge of
right.
how to use it.
Right. The entry fee.
You got to be able to write.
And you're
going to
pay
read.
The monthly fees
right.
for the network.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's kind of the next edge of community work that's happening in your neighborhood right now. Where people are trying to develop ways for the public, especially people who wouldn't be buying their own computer for their own home, to access that whole information network and to learn how to use it at the beginning so that they don't get cut out of it right away. I don't know whether it'll work or not, but we're kind of at the end of our hour.
Yeah, we are. I just wanted to say that when I think about these things and the conversation goes like this, sometimes I'm tempted to the sin of despair. And I think it's important for us not to cave into that. I mean, I never understood when I was in confirmation why we had to pray about despair and other great and shameful sins. And I thought, but I'm beginning to get it about despair. But I think it's really important not to give in to despair and to focus on and work with and concentrate on the capacity building stuff that we all have access to and can see, because that's the witness that we can give. And that's a witness, I think, that's Jesus' witness, that you don't write off anybody, you focus on the good in everyone. And so I would really urge us all to remember that, support each other, and continue our ministries where we are, but don't cave into despair.
Well, what about, I'm sorry, I don't want to send this to you, but what about, it seems like Habitat for Humanity, I know my church is involved with that, as are a number of others, and I live in suburb of St. Paul, but that seems like a program that really is